Here to dive into industry trends with leading ETF experts, this is ETF Spotlight with Nina Mishra.
Hello and welcome to ETF Spotlight. I'm your host, Nina Mishra. My guest today is Nick Kalivas, Senior Equity Product Strategist at Invesco. We're talking about low volatility and high quality factor investing today, which have been so popular this year. Nick, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Nina.
So 2019 has been one of the best years of asset gathering for low volatility ETFs. And in fact, these ETFs took in about $22 billion this year. That is according to Bloomberg data. So let's start with this. Tell us why low volatility ETFs have been so popular.
Well, the key driver here has been the macro backdrop has been very supportive to low volatility investing and has caused investors to embrace the characteristics of low volatility investing, which is this idea of being able to participate in market rallies, but in case something kind of goes wrong, it has potential for downside protection and can limit the sell-off. And if you look at what's gone on, we've seen things like the ISM Manufacturing Index drop from over 60 to below 50 recently. We've seen a material slowdown in S&P 500 profit growth. And at the same time, the geopolitical environment has been very uncomfortable for investors given the trade tensions, given what's going on with Brexit, given signs of the creep of socialism in the U.S., and then some of the events that have transpired in Hong Kong. So the confluence of these factors really has created a nice backdrop for low volatility investing.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, let's talk a little bit about the low volatility anomaly. So we all have studied the traditional finance theories, and they say that investors want, they demand a higher rate of return for taking on greater risks. But, you know, there were some academic studies that showed that lower risk stocks actually rewarded investors with higher risk adjusted returns than the broader market over the long term. So tell us about the low volatility anomaly and about the performance, risk adjusted performance of these low volatility stocks.
Sure. As you said, it's been found in the academic literature that lower risk stocks outperform higher risk stocks over longer market cycles, mm-hmm. and it kind of turns modern finance on its head. What is interesting, or should be maybe clarified a little bit, is that risk reward relationship does hold between broader asset classes. So if you think about stocks versus bonds or commodities versus real estate, you do see that trade-off, but within a specific asset class, let's say large-cap stocks or small-cap stocks, that anomaly exists. And really, the reason it tends to exist is that there are structural issues that essentially break down the assumptions of the financial theory we all learned in the classroom. And there's also human behavioral tendencies which break down some of those assumptions that are present in something like the capital asset pricing model or the theories that we learned back in school. And a few of those reasons are, one, investors sometimes will treat stocks as a lottery ticket, so they'll essentially pay up for riskier stocks, hoping to get the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Mm-hmm. But that process essentially leaves those higher risk stocks overpriced and really not lending them to a strong price appreciation. There's limits to the use of leverage or borrowing, which essentially causes some investors to have to buy riskier stocks, and that too distorts that traditional risk reward trade-off. And then lastly, what you will find is that low volatility stocks tend to be concentrated in certain pockets of the market. And as a result, many institutional investors and even some more smaller investors do not want to take the tracking error that is present to arbitrage away the anomaly. And so really the lottery effect, the limits to leverage, and then the unwillingness to take tracking error all act to allow the anomaly to flourish. And so if you look at the performance, what we have seen, if you take something like SPLV or the name, the Invesco S&P 500 low volatility ETF, it has generated over its life, if you go back to May of 2011 to the end of October, about 70 basis points more in excess return than the S&P 500. So that's consistent with the academic ideas. Mm-hmm. The volatility's been about 22% lower, and the Sharpe ratio's been about 37% higher. And so that is maybe a way to kind of quantify what we have seen. But of course, it's important to measure that over longer periods of time, and there have certainly been pockets in the market where it has underperformed, and that tends to be in periods where the equity market is very strong and the macroeconomic conditions are conducive to risk-taking and robust economic growth.
Oh, very interesting. So you mentioned SPLV, which is the Invesco S&P 500 Low Volatility ETF. And Invesco offers some other low volatility ETFs too. There's a mid-cap low volatility ETF with the ticker symbol XMLV. And then there's one focused on small cap stocks. It has a ticker symbol XSLV. There's one for emerging markets too with the ticker symbol EELV, and an international developed low volatility ETF IDLV. So let's focus on the ones which hold US stocks, SPLV, XMLV, and XSLV. Tell us how stocks are selected and weighted in these ETFs.
Yeah, so it's a very kind of transparent, straightforward methodology that is attempting to hold the 20% of stocks with the lowest volatility within the respective parent index. So you can think about that low volatility quintile of the parent. So maybe clarifying that a little bit, if you think about the S&P 400, for example, you have the 400 stocks. Each of those stocks is ranked by their trailing one-year volatility, so this historic one-year volatility. They rank them all, and then they pick the 80 stocks with the lowest volatility. That goes into the portfolio, and those stocks are weighted by the inverse of their volatility. So the stock with the lowest volatility gets the highest weight, and then that process is repeated every quarter to try to stay true to holding the lowest risk stocks in the universe. And so that's the example in the 400. If you think about the 500, it would be the 100 stocks with the lowest volatility. If you thought about the 600, it would be the 120 stocks with the lowest volatility over the past year.
Okay, great. So we talked about low volatility ETFs offered by Invesco. And another strategy which has been popular this year, it's called minimum variance. And sometimes we get questions from our clients as to what is the difference between low volatility and minimum variance ETFs. And the minimum variance ETF offered by Invesco is the Invesco S&P 500 Minimum Variance ETF with the ticker symbol SPMV. So could you please explain the difference between these two strategies and approaches in selecting and weighting stocks?
Yeah, sure. This is a very, I think, important distinction of these two methodologies, which sometimes can be confused in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So low volatility centers on owning the lowest risk stocks in the universe. Minimum volatility, what you see in our SPMV, is really a portfolio construction methodology that is concentrated on creating a portfolio that has a low volatility point. And in order to do that, it uses the covariances and the kind of does statistical analysis to pair the stocks in the universe together to make a minimum or low volatility portfolio. And one of the ways that that happens, or the way it does happen in this case, is they use an optimizer. The methodology uses an optimizer, and that optimizer picks those stocks to form the low volatility portfolio. Now, one of the issues with optimization, or a byproduct of optimization, is that you can get very strange results, and results that might not be commercially viable. So you might have just a handful of stocks, and a couple of those have very big weights. And that's something that, you know, a client or investor is going to be turned off by. So the solution to that is to actually put on sector constraints and make that optimization conform to the parent index. And the industry convention and the convention that we see in SPMV is putting on a sector constraint of plus or minus 5% to the parent index. And so once that essentially is inserted into the optimizer, you get a commercially viable result, and you get a portfolio that has a minimum low volatility and offers some of the risk mitigation characteristics and some of the upside participation that is present in the broader market. Now, what are some of the outcomes there? Well, first of all, low volatility is very transparent. You can just, you know, measure those stocks. You can see that they're low volatility. Minimum volatility, it's much harder to understand what's going on with that optimizer. And in fact, you will see a lot of higher risk stocks actually in a minimum variance portfolio or minimum volatility portfolio, but they're just paired in a way where the portfolio itself has a low volatility point to it or low volatility characteristic to it. The second thing that really stands out is that the tethering to the parent index, what happens is if a sector becomes stressed, minimum volatility cannot get out of the way. It has to have the parent weight less 5%. And that was really very profound if you looked at that methodology back, let's say, in the tech bubble where the S&P 500 was about 35% technology stocks. A low volatility strategy could steer very clear of that sector, but a minimum volatility strategy had to have 30%, and then essentially as the sector weight of technology, let's say, fell to 20%, minimum volatility would have to have 15%, and you get this situation where you have to ride the sector down. There would be a very similar situation in the financial crisis where financials were about 20% of the S&P 500. Minimum variance would have had to have about 15%, had to ride that financials down. The low volatility methodology allowed the quintile to avoid having exposures in financials or have very small exposures to financials. So the unconstrained nature of low volatility is very attractive when a sector hits a pothole and some kind of trouble really emerges. Now, the last thing I would say is that in terms of capture to the overall market, low volatility will tend to have less down capture and less up capture. Minimum volatility will tend to have more up capture and more down capture. And that relates back to the tethering of the sectors of minimum volatility to the parent index. So you can think about a situation, let's say, like the financial crisis, where financials get hit really hard. Low volatility has a low exposure to that. But when they snap back, what happens is low volatility doesn't have the allocation there to participate, while minimum volatility, you know, had to keep at least 5% below the sector weighting the parent, and it was able to snap back. And so it snaps back faster. And so I think those are really some of the major differences, and you know, hopefully that will flush out some of the factors to think about when investing in low volatility versus minimum volatility solutions.
Yeah, very interesting. So as I, as you mentioned, the sector exposure for these two strategies is quite different. So I'm looking at the portfolio of the minimum variance ETF, SPMV. And in fact, technology has the highest exposure, highest technology gets the highest allocation in the portfolio, about 18%, and then consumer discretionary at about 15%. And these sectors, these are usually more volatile sectors, but they get higher allocation in the portfolio because when you look at the portfolio as a whole, it creates a portfolio which has a low volatility, right?
That's a great way to think about it. You're spot on.
Okay, so another factor which has been very popular this year is quality. And I have read some academic studies that show that high-quality companies, which can be determined by factors like high earnings quality, low leverage, they deliver better risk-adjusted performance over the longer term. But quality can have, you know, 100 different meanings. So tell us what quality means to you. How do you define a quality stock? And also tell us a little bit about the long-term performance of quality factor.
So in the Invesco lineup, we use the S&P definitions of quality. So our large cap version, SPHQ, is based on the S&P 500 quality index, and that index is selecting stocks based on low leverage, so you could think about having a low debt-to-equity ratio, high return on equity, and low accounting accruals, kind of a cash, if you think about low accruals, that means that the company is essentially generating robust cash earnings. And so those three screens are used to define a quality stock. There's a composite of those calculated for each company in the S&P 500, and the 100 with the strongest quality score are selected for the index and hence the ETF. And each one of those factors, low leverage, low accruals, and high return on equity in the academic literature have shown the ability to generate excess return over market cycles. And so that's kind of the academic theory that has been present in the construction process. And I think what you would find is that you know, the performance of that has been you know, very strong over longer periods of time. You tend to see a bit less volatility. You tend to see a higher Sharpe ratio, and you tend to capture about, you know, I'd say 97% of the up to the market and about 77% of the down to the market. So it's what I would consider to be a bit of a defensive strategy, but not as defensive as low volatility. You do tend to see it pay off most greatly in periods of weakening type of economic growth, but it can also participate nicely when the economy is doing well and earnings growth is accelerating.
Okay, very interesting. So let's take a look at your very popular high-quality ETF. It's the Invesco S&P 500 quality ETF with the ticker symbol SPHQ, as you mentioned. And you told us about the factors that are used by S&P 500 and defining quality, return on equity, changes in net operating assets, and financial leverage. So does the ETF use those factors in selecting and weighting stocks?
Yeah, so those three that I mentioned, low debt to equity, high return on equity, and low accounting accruals are used as the screens for the stock. So the ETF is essentially replicating that index that S&P puts together. So that is correct.
Okay. So I'm looking at the portfolio. Information technology, 41%, healthcare, 20%, and then consumer staples, about 10%. And looking at the two top holdings, not surprising at all, some of the best companies in the S&P 500 index, Apple, Microsoft, MasterCard, Johnson & Johnson, and Visa. These are the top holdings in the portfolio. Now, of course, when investors own these ETFs, either low volatility or high quality ETFs, they're kind of making sector bets because these portfolios may differ significantly from the broader market. So tell us what investors need to know about sector bets that they are making by owning these ETFs.
Yeah, so I'm going to answer it on two levels. I think the first thing to realize in terms of low volatility is that the process is bottom up, and because of that, the sector exposures and holdings can change depending on what the quarterly rebalance process reveals or creates. And you can have, at many times, very dynamic movements. So if you think about an SPLV during its lifetime, it's had as much as 30% utilities. It's had less than 3% utilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's had no financials. You know, it's had close to 20% financials. Likewise with REITs. So they are or can be very dynamic strategies. So I would say that about SPLV. And you know, what you have this quarter might not be what you have next quarter. And you have to think about it through the factor lens. Think more about the factor that you're trying to harvest as opposed to the sector. I think on quality, what is interesting to me and is, I think, a issue that a lot of investors are really intrigued by and grappling with is that we have seen in recent years a lot more technology companies show up in meeting of a quality criteria.
Right.
They've kind of grown up. They now are generating more cash.
Mm-hmm.
They don't use a lot of leverage, and they have strong return on equity. And so if you were to if you go back in time, a lot of quality names would have been more like in healthcare or these kind of staples that were stable or these industrials that had kind of, you know, more stable businesses. And in more recent years, you've actually shifted and you've seen much more technology names of surface. So I think that is very interesting. But like low volatility, the quality screen is run. I mean, in this case, it's twice a year, low volatility, four times a year. And you do have that stock selection process that is looking to essentially pick the stocks that are conforming to the index rules and the methodology and trying to harvest the factor to the best of its ability.
Okay, very helpful. So as I mentioned earlier, these strategies have been quite popular this year. But in the past few weeks, we have seen that investors have been, you know, leaving the safer areas of the market, like low volatility, and they are rushing into riskier areas. And that is mainly because the yield curve has uninverted, and there is some optimism regarding trade talks as well. And economic reports, as well as third quarter earnings, have generally been better than expected. So do you think these strategies, low volatility and quality, can still attract investors?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what's been interesting is we have seen some outflow in recent weeks out of low minimum volatility,
mm-hmm,
and out of momentum. And one of the beneficiaries has actually been quality. So we've seen investors kind of step up their risk a little bit, but still have a little bit of bias towards defense. So there has been a rotation into quality. There's also been a lot of rotation into value, to be fair. So money has also kind of traded up into value. Now, I think that the low volatility strategy is going to still have a lot of value because even though the economics are look like they're improving, I think that we have not seen, you know, crystal clear evidence that we are seeing the economy really accelerate a lot.
Right.
And the headline risks are still very present when we think about the upcoming U.S. election. If you just look at today, there was a story on the wire kind of throwing some cold water on a trade agreement. There's a lot of tape risk that is out there. And I think that the kind of smoother ride, that ability to participate in the upside and, you know, potentially get some protection if the market sells off, will play well for investors who are embracing the low volatility solution. So I think there's still a place for that in the portfolio. You know, even strong markets do see corrections, you know, 5-10%. And so it can essentially help improve the investment experience, provide some diversification. And so I think low vol will still have its place. I think those who are wanting to step up on the risk scale but still have, you know, kind of a little bit of a defensive a position, not go all in, will be attracted to quality too as a potential option to kind of play both worlds, one where maybe you're seeing stronger growth, but one that you still have some risks present.
Makes sense. So I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about factor investing in general. So factors like this, low volatility, quality, and you mentioned that investors have been favoring value and momentum factors of late in the past few weeks. So these factors in general, they are highly cyclical. And as you know, timing the market is never easy. So tell us how investors should use these strategies, these factor strategies in their portfolio. Should they be used as core holdings or secondary holdings, or is it better to use a combination of some factors?
Well, the way we think about factors is that essentially over the long period, you have the potential to harvest the excess return. But in the shorter time periods, it's very difficult to, like you said, time the factors and know which one is going to be working. And so the idea is to kind of pair them together or group them together. So, you know, a portfolio can hold multiple factors in it, and they can provide kind of that short-term diversification. And, you know, something will be working in terms of the market conditions that are present, and that will help balance off what might not be working. But over time, assuming that they'll kind of, you know, flip-flop or cycle over time, and you can harvest the premium. So pairing together factors like momentum, value, low volatility, or quality can essentially create a very robust portfolio. One that can essentially, you know, weather kind of the ups and downs that take place over shorter periods of time, but really allow the potential for higher return. So we suggest that investors should group them together and should also think about just rebalancing them, you know, on some periodic basis, because there's going to be periods where they some do well, so you might want to cut your exposure from that, and there's going to be ones that do poorly, and you might want to add to them when they're kind of out of favor, assuming that they'll mean revert over time, and one will be able to harvest the premium or the anomaly that is present.
Okay, excellent suggestions. That's all we have time for today. Nick, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to learn more about these ETFs, please visit Invesco.com. Make sure to be on the lookout for the next edition of ETF Spotlight, and also make sure to subscribe. If you have any comments or questions, please email podcast@zacks.com.
This material is being provided for informational purposes only, and nothing herein constitutes investment, legal, accounting, or tax advice, or a recommendation to buy, sell, or hold a security. Do not act or rely upon the information and advice given in this podcast without seeking the services of competent and professional legal, tax, or accounting counsel. Publication and distribution of this podcast is not intended to create, and the information contained herein does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. No recommendation or advice is being given as to whether any investment or strategy is suitable for a particular investor. It should not be assumed that any investments in securities, companies, sectors, or markets identified and described were or will be profitable. All information is current as of the date herein and is subject to change without notice. Any views or opinions expressed may not reflect those of Zacks Investment Research as a whole.